I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today I'm joined by Jeff Shackelford, contributing writer for Golf Week and also a Golf Channel analyst, I guess you would say. Jeff, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Andy?
I hope that interview or that introduction served you well, you know.
That did the job.
Big week on the PGA Tour with the Byron Nelson heading to Trinity Forest. I think you and I are in the same boat with our affinity for minimalist golf design. Wanted to see what your thoughts were on the golf course tournament and all things else AT&T Byron.
Well, the golf course was sensational, and you know, you and I sat next to each other in the press center there and argued, and the guy in front of us only turned around like four times, and gave us a look. I don't know if that was our swearing or if that was our bickering, but it was a huge week for the school of golf course design that I've subscribed to, and you do, and have practiced a little bit too. And so I was very nervous knowing what I had seen going into the tournament and not seeing anything that made me feel like, oh boy, they're going to love this course. I just didn't see the visuals. Well, once you got on the ground, it's just not a course that is going to photograph that well to most people. And gosh, when I'm still thinking about some of the holes and the greens, and it just – is the I think it a case can be made it's the best thing that design that Ben and Bill and the boys have done with a site that didn't give them a lot, and it's their I'd say their boldest in terms of greens and strategy, and I just everything about it really blew me away. I mean, there's only one hole I'm kind of iffy on that I'd like to hit some shots too, but just watching play, I didn't think maybe quite worked. But other than that, I thought every hole had something special, different, interesting. It had different ways to play. It looked like based on different hole locations and different winds. So that said, you know, I know how you feel. The golf course should have been firmer and faster, and it probably should have been, but I've seen enough of the Chambers Bays of the world to know that this could have really backfired. And we can get into, I think, how Aaron Wise validated the design despite the softness. But to me, they had to do with what they did, and it was very successful from the tournament and golf point of view. I don't know about the spectator side, but certainly from the architecture and PGA Tour side, I thought it was a home run.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, am I crazy or is it crazy that the world's best players came to a golf course and played it slower than regular members see it day in, day out?
It's a little crazy, but I think we just have too many examples in recent years of setup being a little too shocking for a golf tournament or pay, you know, remember their pace of play issues with tour golf. And I just think that they had to err on the side of greener, a little greener, softer to prevent the players saying, well, that was a freak show. We're never going back. And so that was why I thought it was the right move. And I think they were a little nervous about some of the wind that was in the forecast. Some of it materialized one day and another day it didn't. And then the rain, of course, I mean, how many times do we hear that no rain this week? And that happened on Sunday, but yeah, it's very unusual. And I think next year the course will be allowed to be mown a little bit tighter than it was this year, would be my guess, now that the setup staff knows what how things function and speed, pace of play, how it functions and where there are backups and what holes played maybe a little too easy because they were the ball wasn't running out. But other than that, I think it was the right move. They were very nervous about this venue on a lot of fronts. You just can't underestimate how much AT&T is an important part of the PGA Tour, and not wanting to have them have some sort of an embarrassment, I think, was really at the forefront of their minds, and I understand that.
A lot of golf fans are kind of obsessed with this concept of score to par. So
the
people in that school of thought kind of look at the tournament and say, they lit it up. What would be your response to them defending, you know, kind of in defense of Trinity Forest as a test of the world's best?
Well, one, no player left there, I guarantee you, Sunday night and said, well, that was a waste of a week. That was too easy. I don't feel tested. I'm not coming back. If you could see the golf course in person, you know that, yes, they scored well, but they earned it. It required a lot of thought, a lot of precision, and creativity at times. I mean, how fun was it yesterday to watch Aaron Wise just putting on this unbelievable ball striking and putting display? But then there was Brandon Grace and there were Mark Leishman playing a little bit more like veterans, and I mean, Leishman had a 4-iron around a green he used, and also using some ingenuity, and there was a little more shot shaping. And so there were multiple ways to play the course, and multiple people played it very well. But the numbers are staggering from Wise. The ShotLink people sent out something this morning. I finally got to – I was kind of hoping to get it last night, and it just is astounding that he – His 91.67% on greens and regulation is the highest 4-round stroke play number by a winner since 1997. So that, I mean, that's just an astounding number. I know the greens are big, and I know he's hitting iron off a bunch of tees because he hits it so bloody far. But it's just still. You know, it was so impressive watching him down the stretch. You just kept waiting for him to crack a little. And every time he kind of – that last night he had a couple of shots he didn't like, and he missed them in the right spot. And so you have to just admire that so much, that not only was he so consistent, but then when he did miss, he missed on the right spot and the run, avoided the short-siding himself or whatever you want to call it, putting himself in the wrong place. And for a 21-year-old, that is just that's just so impressive. So I would say that ultimately the players will walk away having been sort of entertained by the course. I don't know if it fit because of the setup, what Jeff Ogilvie said to us there in the press conference earlier in the week, that players will want to come there because it'll make them a better golfer. I think that when it gets ratcheted up, you know, a little bit and the setup, that forecast of his will come true. But certainly nobody left there feeling cheated. I've never heard of. Have you ever heard of a player leaving a tournament saying, "Well, they're not coming back because it was too easy"? I've never heard that myself. I mean, maybe I've heard of players say, "I don't go to that tournament because I can't shoot 25 under."
Kuchar,
but I've never heard.
Kuchar might not be back.
Well, he may not be back, but that's okay. He plays every other week anyway, so. But other than that, yeah, nobody spoke up. I don't know if there was some other report. Was there somebody else besides Kuchar? Because Jordan Spieth, in his final round press conference, noted twice, kind of took a little jab at the media, sort of about reporting. Make sure you report that a certain way. It was kind of an odd ultimatum, and I'm guessing he read somebody being critical or somebody's comments taken a certain way, and they had said something the opposite to him in person. It might have been Kuchar. I don't know. And I'll be honest with you, I'm a little shocked that Kuchar said what he said, because he's somebody who goes to the Scottish Open and loves this kind of golf. And maybe he just loved the Four Seasons there. I don't know. But it surprised me, of all people, that he spoke.
It shocked me. I picked Kuchar in my like one and done leagues, because I'm like, said this to you, I was walking around the golf course, God, this place is perfect for Kuchar.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
Like I think one of the things with the rain that happened was that the rain and the softer conditions made it more of a bomber's paradise on Sunday, as you know. Sure. You would expect with wide fairways and soft conditions. I think Adam Scott said it in his post-round interview with Amanda Baliones. It's like, she was like, well, and he was like, well, it's, I mean, 90-yard fairways and soft conditions. Nobody's going to really make a big number. I think on Saturday, it was just so fascinating because you had Wise and you had Leishman, but then you also had Kevin Na and Brian Gay. You know,
yeah.
Brian Gay competing with Wise, who's one of the longest players on tour. Like, you don't get to see that very often. And I think with golf, we fall into this trap in the social media era of golf that everybody becomes obsessed with these 400-yard drives. But like, if everybody hits it 400 yards, it's not nearly as interesting as watching Aaron Wise hit it 360 yards and Brian Gay hitting it 280, competing at an equal level.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the variety was incredible. And I think that just speaks to the... that has to be a statement about the architecture. There's just no other way to put it. I was amazed, of course, as I always am, how far they were hitting it. And, you know, they were getting good run on the ball. Of course, certain CBS broadcasters had to note the role, because, of course, it's not the players who hit the ball a long way. Well, it's a links golf course, so 50 yards of roll should not be a shock.
It's not that the ball isn't spinning, because everything's just perfectly optimized to generate 50 yards a roll.
But yeah, it was really interesting to look at some of the names and look at the people who played well. And but that last day, the scoring was kind of astonishing. I mean, to see some people shoot 69 and get passed by a lot of people just suggests that they saved some pretty simple hole locations. And then obviously the rain just did render the course pretty defenseless. But the ball was rolling out pretty nice. I mean, I watched every minute of it up to the end, and the ball was still running in the fairways nicely after the rain delay.
Yeah, I think where the fire wasn't, I was even a little disappointed on Saturday. You have this hot and windy day, and having played the golf course, spent a ton of time on it in November, I watching guys spin back wedge shots, like downwind, you know, that's where, to me, the PGA Tour and got a little soft.
Yeah, I think, though, we discussed this, and I don't want to go down an equipment rat hole, but my biggest takeaway from watching tour golf this year and walking out on a couple of greens is just how much the guys are able to control the ball to firm greens. Those greens at Sawgrass, Andy, were I was out. I actually got to hit some putts. I went out with the guys doing setup on Saturday and a little bit on Sunday. And I dropped a putter, you know, just gently to kind of, and the thump sound was like, wow, these things have got nice firmness to them. And then you go and watch the telecast and you see the way they spin the ball. And I saw it at Riviera this year. I was just floored by how much spin guys could put on the ball out of what was very light rough, but two greens that were, if the average golfer tried to play a shot to them, they'd probably be running the ball right through the green. And so I don't want to say that the grooves are needing to be looked at, but it is really hard to set up a golf course now with as much spin as the players put on their approaches. And then the fairways at Sawgrass were incredible. These fairways were very good. Although, as you noted, they would have been amazing, just cut just a bit tighter, and the amount of spin guys can put on the ball with a tight lie. I think it also speaks to how much that fairway, that longer fairway grass at Augusta, probably impacts things because the guys don't seem to quite spin the ball as much when they land the ball on the green there from the fairway. But so anyway, what goes for a firm green on the tour is actually rather soft for them, but for the rest of us, we'd be pretty shocked at how firm some of them are these days.
Since everybody agrees that the game's changed, whichever side of the distance debate you're on, everybody says, well, the game's changed. Why is it that our society still holds on to par as the same number?
Yeah, it's been something that is always an issue in this discussion. And it's hard for people, I guess, to kind of go a little bit deeper. And thankfully we have more stats now that I think just more people have come to realize it's not sacred. I think I wrote at least one chapter in my Future of Golf book about this, which is now 15 years ago, but this absurd sanctity of par nonsense. There's just so much more to looking at a golf tournament and a golf hole and the way a course plays than how it plays to par, as we saw this week, just with the change in weather and wind, and it's so boring too. I mean, who cares if par is protected? It's more about, did you sense that the best players were able to play shots and be rewarded for them? And if they make birdies, they make birdies. And they, of course, the other thing that makes it all so ridiculous is that conditioning has never been better. I mean, the golf course conditioning this year at every tour event I have been to has just been astounding how good it is. And you give good players the kind of green smoothness and fairway lies and even bunker lies that they're getting, and you can't protect par. Give it up. It's stupid. And that just does not get factored in enough, how much conditioning allows players to score and frees them up to worry about other stuff. To put it another way, it doesn't distract them the way it used to, when you used to get more spike marks and bumpy POA greens. And I mean, they still say the POA is bumpy, and I guess it is compared to some of the grasses, but they don't know bumpy POA on the PGA Tour anymore. I mean, it is a beautiful, beautiful POA strain that they get to face. So yeah, par is, it's a silly thing. And it's funny, all the people who like to mention that scoring hasn't changed in defending the distance argument were very quiet around the players, other than to say, wow, look, a guy who doesn't hit a very far one. But otherwise, they torched that place. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, the greens were not soft. They were firm. But they had perfect fairways and perfect conditions to clip a ball off of and control the ball.
Yeah, I kind of think this is the steroid era of golf. And you know, if you compare it to the steroid era of baseball, you know, not players are not taking steroids, just to be very clear. I'm talking about the equipment. Yeah. but if you compare it to the steroid era of baseball, all of a sudden games got unbelievably long, and long-standing records were just being shattered left and right. And if you look at golf right now, like, the rounds are getting egregiously long. And, you know, scoring records are falling left and right, and you're seeing more and more young players that you're losing the variety in the game. And I think, like, that's the core of the problem, is that if you look at baseball during the steroid era, it became so power oriented. Everybody was just trying to play. The strategy of the game changed, where people were just waiting for home runs. Take the steroids away, and all of a sudden you're seeing the baseball that everybody loves, with like hit and runs, you know, they're stealing bases. Like, pitchers are all of a sudden, like, you know, you don't have to be just a power pitcher. Like, the games are shorter now also. Like, the game got better by taking the steroids away, even though everybody believed in this chicks dig the long ball. And I feel like golf's in the exact same place right now.
It most certainly is. And it's been obviously evolving this way. And that's why last week was a nice reminder, as you noted, all the variety on the leaderboard, the golf course did. It didn't discriminate against the long hitter, but it also allowed some people who play a little bit different kind of game to contend. And was I thought that was a great thing. But I sense that we're probably in the minority on that. Certainly the PGA Tour's position now is to promote distance, and they're going to resist any effort to do anything about it. Despite the fact that it's as you know, I mean, the pace of play is just astonishing. Riviera this year had no rough and beautiful weather, and they could not break 520 as a threesome. Trinity Forest, no rough, perfect condition, mild weather, and for the most part. And they also could not really break that barrier until Sunday when they needed to finish. And although Kevin Na really tried to send it into Monday there. But they and by the way, they're all shooting 65. They're making everything and taking as few shots as possible yesterday. And they just barely finished in that window they had, which was really tight. And so it's really fascinating. I mean, I talked to some players last week. We just kind of had an accidental 45 minutes together in a van while a thunderstorm passed. And they asked they didn't know that I'd like written a whole book about this and obsessed about the topic. So I prefaced some of my comments, but they asked about the bifurcation concept, and I started taking them through Riviera and the number of playing opportunities that will be lost there when they reduce the field because you can't finish the first two rounds and it just doesn't work that time of year with a 144 player field. And you know, when they finally hear that 24 playing spots are going to go away at a great golf course like that, they start to get some understanding. And so I don't know where it's going to go, but the tour certainly thinks that people tune in to watch long hitting, and of course they don't. They love to watch players control the ball, spin the ball. I mean, that was the only thing I felt deprived of a little bit this week at Trinity Forest was, and I think you did too. We wanted to see more balls land and feed. I mean, Zach Blair shot on Sunday on 17, where he took the flag out and he chipped it way up the slope and then brought it back after he did his tee shot long, was so cool. I thought we'd see a little bit more of that. And I think the softness and the slowing down of the course deprived us of a few more of those moments, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think Leishman hit that low chaser on Saturday into the 18th where, you know, it was a backish pin and he hit, you know, a flighted six iron in there that landed on the front edge and ran right back there. And he was one of like, you know, six or seven players that got the ball within 12 feet because he hit the proper shot. And I think that's something that sticks with me always with, I had a conversation about a year ago with Jeff Ogilvie, and he said, you know, the biggest crime to golf fans is the fact that they don't get to see Rory McIlroy hit all of the shots that he's capable of because the golf courses don't ask them of him. No. So he doesn't practice them.
Nope. And, you know, we saw with Bubba this year at Riviera, people were oohing and aahing, watching the ball move in the air. And you just go to any golf tournament and you just don't hear oooing and aahing on a tee shot. Maybe if somebody drives the green on a short par four, but otherwise you hear it when you see spin, you see, you know, when fans recognize that somebody hits a recovery shot, that's really good. Or when they land a ball and feed it, it's just so much more fun to watch. And so that's something that we do get deprived of too much. And we got it a little bit this week and we got it obviously like normal at Augusta and people respond to it there. So, you know, it's one of those things where if I were commissioner for a day, I would commission a focus group to kind of look at all that stuff. And I think you'd find that if you ask people to watch shots and what they respond to most, that the people who are really living under par are loving the stuff around the greens that goes on, where these guys show they're on another level, even maybe on another level from really good amateur golfers even. You know, we're just the stuff they can do with controlling the ball.
You know, the idea of par threes are generally the most photographed and the most, you know, popular hole for the regular golfer because it levels the playing field. Anybody on a par three can, any golfer could hit a better shot than Tiger Woods in his prime on a par three. You know, if the probability is right. And I think something with that is like a regular golfer watching Dustin Johnson hit it 380 yards. That's not relatable.
No.
That's not a shot they ever think about, ever see themselves hitting. But watching Dustin Johnson hit a shot from around the green, all of a sudden that becomes much more relatable, and it's more like the game they play.
Yeah.
And it's something they can actually tangibly take and try. You know, like the shot Zach Blair hit is something that if somebody's playing an interesting golf course could all of a sudden look at the backside of a contour and say, hey, I'm going to try and hit it away from the flag to get it close to the flag. And that's so cool, is that that is a relatable shot. And that's why it's, I mean, I think about it all the time, is if you go back, say, 15 years and look at the 10 greatest shots of the last decade from, let's just say, 2000 to 1985. How many of them would be drives or missile straight iron shots close to flags? Like maybe one.
I was trying to think of one, and the only one I first came to mind was Andrew McGee driving and making the albatross at TPC Scottsdale, but we don't have video of that. So yeah, I'll think of one. I'm sure there's one. Ricky Fowler. Well, no, that one, they always show the ones on 17 at the Players, but really the one he hit, the drives he hit on 18 were the ones that were so impressive. But again, no, I can't think of any at the moment.
But if you think about the recent time, like one of the things that would stick in my mind as one of the most famous shots is Dustin Johnson hitting a dead straight laser tee shot on 18 at Oakmont and a laser iron shot. Balls that didn't move an inch, you know? And if you think back, like, I always think about Tiger's, like, cut six iron at the Canadian Open, or Tiger's, you know, that shot he hit at Olympia Fields where he bended it, like, you know, 50 yards left to right out of the rough. And those shots just don't exist anymore.
No, they don't very often, and but when they do, people love it and they talk about it. So it's just it's imperative that people in charge of the sport. I mean, that's what I guess where I scratch my head is you'd think they would study these things and know what viewers respond to. I mean, look at Tracer. Look, there's a reason Tracer has become popular and demanded by the viewer. Part of it is to have instant feedback. Part of it is it just looks cool if you're sitting around in a where it's going. And then when you see a player move the ball, either in a bad way or a good way, it's just visually it's interesting and it gets your attention. So the signs are there, but the concern is that the people in charge think that, you know, it's just all the usual stuff that young people want to see these guys be athletes and respond to distance and on and on. And I just don't think that logically that case can be validated. I mean, I'd love to see the numbers if they did some study on this, but we're impressed with somebody's stats, but we're not really visually. It doesn't do anything for us when we're watching.
Yeah, I also think like setup wise, like firm and fast is so important. I think about last year, like two of the best maintained venues, like they stick out in my mind. Like I don't like TPC Potomac from an architecture standpoint, but that tournament last year was so crispy, so firm and fast that it was fascinating. But what it does is it when it's firm and fast, it brings variety into the game. It devalues the driver, which sounds so counterintuitive, but it's like golf, like with anything. When the ball rolls, that brings more players into the mix than just the power hitters, because it decreases their margin for error.
Sure, and that's what will hopefully be on display at Shinnecock Hills in a few weeks. I don't know. It's so weather dependent. It's been a rough year, but I'm about to start going through for Golf Week to do 10 players to watch, and it's kind of a tough one when you don't have when most of the field has never been there. But you kind of have to assume that they'll try to get it that way. The year Corey Pavin won, it got to that point. It also got to that point in 2004, but it went too far. And by the way, that's one thing I've been, and not to go off into that, but you know, Shinnecock people are kind of fascinated by the widening and the numbers versus last time, and how could they possibly be wider even though they just narrowed it and this and that. Was like, you have to remember, they're just like with Aaron Hills, they're expecting wind and getting it really firm and fast, and they're accounting for that. And guess what? Sometimes that doesn't; those two things don't happen. And so, isn't it better though to err on the side of players being able to attack, and they just, when the weather's down or the firmness doesn't happen, they score and they're still playing a very hard golf course. I just don't understand the idea people not quite understanding that it's very hard to get it all dialed in. And obviously, especially when you have no control over the weather. So sometimes it's just not going to be perfect. There is an ideal, and you have to account for the ideal with the width of the course. And they did that at Aaron Hills. It didn't happen. They really did it at Shinnecock. And although now I've heard they're rewidening. So I, in a couple spots, maybe we'll get some reports from the media day today on that.
Yeah, it sticks with me is what Jeff Ogilvie said on that State of the Game last week is, you know, the great golf holes are ones that a tour pro, if they want to make a par, can almost always make a par, but all of a sudden they get so hard when they try and make birdie. And to me, that is like the core of golf, is like, if you want to play safe and make a par, it's pretty simple for that tour pro. But when they have to really get aggressive and make that birdie, that's when they bring six or seven into play. And that, it's just such a simple concept.
Yeah, but it requires good design, and it requires a setup that matches. And I know that's where your beef with Trinity was. I think it could have had exactly that last week. They'll no doubt sit back and realize that after they evaluate it. But I also think that year one they had to make sure they didn't mess that up and go too far the other way, and then make guys watching go, well, that was goofy and we don't need to see that. That's why we have something to look forward to next year when they return to Trinity Forest.
Where would you rank Trinity Forest in your, say, regular PGA Tour stops?
Mm. Wow. Well, I mean, I'm the wrong person to ask in that I'm looking at Pure Design. But that's an interesting question, because Pure Design-wise, you know, to me on the tour, it's Pebble and Riviera are kind of in another area, another sphere, really. Augusta, to me, has been just too mangled in too many spots to be, and even Riviera has been, and even Pebble has been. But if we're match playing holes and all that, those two generally are always near the top. And I mean, to me, Trinity Forest is already in the top, easily in the top five. I'm struggling to. I'm not a Harbor Town fan, so you have to remember that I'm not one of those who thinks small greens and trees overhanging and all that is just that great. Yeah. So, I mean, Pure Design wise, if we got into a match play tournament, I think Trinity Forest would hold up really well. I mean, you just, and again, a lot of people sent messages like, what are you talking? This course is just, I don't get it. And I'm just like, you just have to see it on the ground. CBS just didn't quite capture it, but every hole has some twist to it and so many interesting elements and it's such beautiful construction. And I think the thing there is a feeling of randomness to all the contours out there. But then I just could tell early on that it's the kind of course, and why Spieth has has grown to love it as he's played it, that there is meaning to all of the contours, and that they gave you elements to work shots off of to certain holes. And, you know, to me, the great random designs like that, seemingly random, actually have things that as a player you learn and you can remember key features, and you know when you hit it in the wrong side, you're screwed, and that kind of thing. So
it
just had a lot going on. It's really sensational.
One of the best things that happened, I think, was that delay let people see the front nine more so than they would have seen had it not been delayed on Sunday. But like the seventh hole, that par five, is one of the most fun holes to watch guys hit second shots. It's reachable for every player in the field. And they, you know, Bill and Ben leave that right side. There's 70 yards of short grass right of the green, just wide open. You can bail out right all day. And these guys started to figure out that was dead over there, but they didn't want to take on the hazard line, which the greens press right up against. And you could just see them, the agony in their face when they watched their ball starting to go right, because they just couldn't get it over to the left. Like, and you could just tell from their facial expressions, they're like, there's no way I can make birdie from over there, you know, or I have to hit a miraculous shot to make birdie from over there.
Yeah.
And that is so great, you know, from a design standpoint of forcing people into discomfort if they want to get the reward of a birdie.
Well, especially with all the short grass and the width and yeah, you're right. As they went, they started to know the nuances of the design. And Matt Jones almost made an incredible up and down, by the way, when he bailed out right there.
That was an unbelievable chip shot.
But yeah, and the other thing on that too, what I loved was there was a great shot. It was probably accidental, but of the players on 8 green, and you saw the players in 7 in the distance. Right there, kind of, and both were watching each other. Again, that was just a cool little Lynx-like touch. There were just so many elements like that I thought were fascinating. I 8 never really quite played, from what I grasped, to your point on the front nine coverage the way I hoped, because I saw so much of it. PGA Tour Live seemed to have a lot of front nine coverage. And I don't know if that was just the green softness, but it didn't quite.
I think they were pretty cautious with pins too.
Yeah. Like
the hole locations were left a little bit to be desired. And tees, I think they moved so many tees up that golf course was playing about 200-300 yards shorter than it could. And I think that especially when you look at like 17, having that tee like 20-30 yards up kind of diminishes what was built with the contouring.
Yeah, I think that one's on Spieth. I think he kind of issued a statement there early in the week. I don't think he likes that hole at 200 yards. It sounded to me like he had been, when they asked his thoughts, that was probably, it sounded just picking apart his comments. That sounded to me like the one, I don't want to say ultimatum, but the one piece of input he gave them was that hole just plays better to him in the 150 to 170 range. And I would agree with you. It would have been fun just see one day them play 17 longer and see what happens, you know, maybe Sunday.
It's an epidemic of this soliciting player feedback for changes. Like, of course,
well,
they're
especially since 200 yards is it's a 7 or a 6 iron now, it seems like. So come on, guys, you can do it. You can hit a 6 iron. I know you can. You're really talented. Come on.
I think there's like a George Lowe quote that's like, you know, it's the job of equipment manufacturers and instructors to continue to make players better and figure things out, and then it's the job of the architect to combat this with thoughtful design. And that's a perfect example of it, is like combat the high trajectory shot with contours that require a low running shot to get it close.
Yeah, I was amazed how wigged out guys were by that hole. And I think that was also a product of just how little they practiced the course and played. Well, first of all, there was so clearly last year, the feedback, and Spieth touched on this in his post-round press conference yesterday, the feedback from the caddies on that caddy day was awful. And it was, the course was really firm and fast, and it was, had the new green firmness. And obviously some of the veteran caddies understood that there's a there's firm, and then there's that new turf firmness where you just can't hold any kind of shot. And so some of them obviously took that into account, but that hole may have been the one that freaked them out the most from that word of mouth element. But that said, it should have been one where they adjusted or ignored them. I can't remember, where were we going down? Which rattle hole were we about to go down on the equipment?
So we'll change the subject. Did you feel? I mean, watching the CBS coverage, I just don't really think they did much to showcase the course. They talked a lot about options, but
yeah,
there wasn't anything that. I feel like they really dropped the ball when it comes to having an opportunity to inform and educate viewers about this different style of golf. And I read, you know, you read replies to, you know, different big outlets, tweets about the course being so cool. And you see so many people that are like, what? It looks like a cow pasture. So, yep. I mean, what would you have done if you were running the broadcast differently?
Well, I mean, for starters, you had the plane, thank God, that started flying when CBS went on the air. So the PGA Tour Live and Golf Channel coverage literally was like watching a golf tournament from about 30 years ago. I mean, just ground camera shots. I still don't even remember seeing a shot from that crane camera they had out there, which would have been really nice to see more of, especially you had so many spots on the course where you had intersections where that should have been more useful. I mean, give us a shot, a 17, a speed shot, what Tommy Roy calls it for NBC of that ball flying and then landing if somebody was landing it short of the par three green. But for instance, I mean, it's, how hard is it? You have the airplane. Okay. And I know it's moving at a decent clip. But you can pause above the third hole. You can freeze a shot that if you can't, if you don't want to use the digital graphics, just give us an aerial view of the third hole and use a telestrator to say, okay, when the pin's over here in the back right, you do want to drive it past this fairway bunker to get the better angle in. And Zach Blair and Joel Dahman are having a nice little, a friendly back and forth on that right now on Twitter, but show that strategy, use the telestrator to say, okay, Saturday, today's pin, you know, you've got to get it past this bunker. So far this week, everybody's just automatically laid up. Give us just the basic strategy there. Give us some sense of some of the things you're talking about with, the fifth hole or on the back nine. I mean, 14, there were so many little elements they could have pointed out. 18 with the telestrator. I don't even know if there was a telestrator on the property. Fox would have done a great job. They're the ones who've been the most interested in golf course design of just getting a few camera views, maybe up behind a tee a little bit and getting up 20 yards or 20 feet in the air, just to give us that better sense of what the player's looking at. But this was one that really needed either digital renderings of the greens or somebody, you know, like Johnny Miller does with a telestrator, showing you just some basic arrows and lines, what the issues are. Because the camera just flattened those contours out. I mean, people, you watch the 10th green on television and you had no concept of how wicked that green is and what's going on there. And a couple little lines would give you that sense. Why was that the second hardest hole for the week? Well, you know, the give best, us something.
The best was on Saturday. I think Faldo said, well, he moves on to 10. That's not a nothing hole. It's just a 400 yard hole. It's like, oh my, like if you walked that golf course, if you saw that golf course at all and understood like what that green, you know, how it was hitting a shot into that green, it's like that is a terrifying golf shot. And I think, like, I think back to like those Ogilvy videos that AT&T, the tournament.
Those
did.
Were great. Yeah.
I mean, low production costs, like those thing cost nothing to do. And, you know, if they would have just even shown one of
just
those.
Play. Yeah, exactly. Just play those. Yeah. It's going to and from commercial. Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's a, they did a disservice to the tournament and the golf course and the way they covered the event. It's absolutely mind-blowing how, like, you know, you've got, this is your one job, and you can't figure out at a very basic level, like, how can we, you know, I mean, that's the job of a telecast, is to explain, feel like somebody sitting on their couch is there.
Right.
And this was the one story at this tournament. It wasn't the field, you know?
No, no. In fact, it was a great way to get away from discussing that that there were people who surfaced in the field that we didn't know still played professional golf. And it requires a little bit of planning. It requires caring about architecture. And as you know, it's always a fight to convince broadcasters that the course is a big part of the story. Fox has embraced that more than NBC and CBS for sure. And then it requires, I think, a lot of the announce crew to arrive early or at some point and get out and watch some of the golf and bend the ears of Bill and Ben. And I'm sure that they did have discussions. But on the production side, you've got to kind of want to make that venue a protagonist. And, you know, generally over and over again, they don't. And it's something that is perplexing to me. The feeling is just keep showing shots and showing somebody putting for par. I mean, watching Kevin Na putt for par can take a minute and a half, and you could have shown one of those Ogilvy videos in that time, and the viewer would have been fascinated by it, and they wouldn't have changed the channel. I guarantee you that.
I think I've never looked at individual event ratings, but my general feel is that the most popular tour stops year to year are Riviera and the, you know, if you ask somebody to refer to the event in LA, they usually say Riviera. I would say another one is Sawgrass, which is architecturally interested. Pebble Beach, you know, like the best golf courses put on the best events also.
Sure. They're old friends that we like to tune into and see how they've changed or not changed. And we recognize them. And there's a comfort level there that certainly attracts people. And it's just like with baseball stadiums. You're just more prone to watch a game at Wrigley Field or Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium versus a game at the Devil Rays play or the Rays play at. Or
what about the Astros Stadium, where remember that when it came out they had the hill and the flagpoles in play?
don't get me going on that rinky-dink pile of garbage park. That
was like a big waterfall behind the 18th green.
Oh, well, they're pretty much, yeah. I mean, they have the train. Do the train still go? I think it does when they hit a home run. I try not to think about that. That stupid park costs the Dodgers a world championship, and it just annoys the hell out of me. Well, they have the hill in center field.
Yeah.
They got rid of that, but that rinky-dink left field that, you know, it's a little pitching wedge out of there. And anyway, but yeah, so the point is, though, that there's an ambiance, and whether people recognize it or not, they just kind of know it. There's certain places that are just more interesting to watch, and it really should be up to television to tell us a little bit more. I mean, that's another thing that's also lost is golf tournament telecasts used to have a little bit of a travelogue element, whether it was just blimp shots or Bob Drum or some little featurettes that would kind of show you what's going on in that town. And Dallas has a lot of interesting stuff going on golf wise, but you know, it's tough. They've got a lot of bills to pay and promos to run. And so all those things kind of chip away at the ability to do some of these features too. But still, yeah, this is a year where I mean, AT&T is a big sponsor, and they deserved, I thought they deserved better coverage.
I'd say that, you know, I think you're in agreement that it was a success. And say it opens the door to maybe some more interesting golf courses. What would be a few golf courses that you'd highlight that would be a feasible, you know, everybody always says, oh, Cypress Point, like that's not going to happen. Yeah. But a feasible golf courses, courses that could host PGA Tour events around the country that are unique and offer different challenges from, you know, the monotonous rough line, tree lined, water hazard right golf we generally see.
Do you have any nominations? Because I'm struggling. I mean, it's just there's so many elements that go into hosting a tour event, space wise, and I mean Trinity Forest, frankly, is right on the edge of not
space
being capable.
So
I haven't talked to fans. I got a couple of tweet responses saying, you know, the fan experience was a disaster. I don't know the specifics if that was heat related or shuttle related. So I do want to find that out. But it was right on the edge of not being workable in a lot of different ways, and I thought they made parts of it work. But I mean, like, I'm looking at a couple of lists right now, and I'm not seeing any places that currently are places that you'd love to see a tour event at. I'm not seeing any of those being functional. mostly geographically. I mean, most of them are just in remote locations.
One that jumps to my mind, and I don't know if the membership would ever want this or allow it.
The answer is no. Oh, but go ahead. I could, whenever you preface it that way.
Well, it comes with Steph Curry looking at doing a event where he's the host. Cal Club,
yeah. I looked at Cal Club one time on some aerials, and I think it's a great choice. It's a fall event. It'd be more of a boutique tour event. I think that's a great nomination.
There's some space, too.
There's a couple of schools nearby, as I recall, which helps.
It's close to the airport.
Possibly.
And how cool would it be to see golf in San Francisco? That's something that bugs me. There's no regular tour event in Chicago or San Francisco.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, I mean, San Francisco's going to have a PGA Championship. Does Chicago have a major?
Nothing
on the schedule. That's amazing. Really, I mean, that's probably a story that needs to be hammered home a little bit more. The playoff event, the Western Open becoming this sort of scatterbrain Rota thing, and then no majors. To go to one of the arguably the best golf market in terms of at least support for tournaments in my lifetime. And certainly if you read the history going back, the Western Open was such a vital event. And when you think about all the other things going on, the Evans Scholars and just the public golf scene and the number of great clubs, it's really astonishing what golf has done to that market, how New York obsessed it got and how it's just dropped Chicago for, I don't even know the reason.
Think about some of the cities that don't have regular tour stops. You got Minneapolis, you've got Chicago, you've got Philadelphia, you have San Francisco, you have, Cleveland. That's a pretty crazed golf area. Like the Midwest, they've taken away all the, you know, and then you've got a world golf championship in Memphis. And I know that this was a business move, but the world golf championships to me is maybe the biggest failure in golf from providing, like, you know, you only get the best players in the world together 8 times a year, 4 of them at the majors. And then, you know, the other 4 you play at now it'll be Firestone to TPC Southwind. You play Austin Country Club, which it's a nice little course, but like, I mean, you get the best players in the world together, play premier golf courses.
Well, and that is a venue that gives you an example of some of the dilemmas involved with trying to find good venues for a tour event. I mean, Austin Country Club gets paid probably better than any venue on the tour to host, and visually it looks great and it works for match play. So I have no beef with it. But it does show you that there are some places where the members don't want it, or the place doesn't fit for television or for spectators. And so there it is tricky. But you did, in the tour's defense, you reeled off some cities there where they are making an effort to try to get, there's somebody who really wants to host a tour event in Minneapolis to convert that Champions event. San Francisco clearly is a market that, the PGA of America's got two PGAs going there. The only two West Coast PGAs, by the way, in the next 10 years on the schedule. And they have this possible Steph Curry event. And you mentioned one other city I'm drawing a blank now on that has something in the works. Philadelphia. I think there's definitely an interest by various organizations. I mean, I think Aronimink's going to get a PGA. Philadelphia Cricket Club's going to get more attention.
Something
and more events.
They're going to lose Boston, though, probably, with the Dell, right?
They're going to lose what? I'm sorry.
Boston. The Boston event?
Yeah, although I'm having I'm just sensing that there's going to be an effort to save that. I just don't think that, because if you release a new tour schedule, and not to go down the rat hole of markets, because most people probably could care less about the business side, but If you go ahead with the schedule they're talking about, you say goodbye to Boston, you've turned New York into a rota that includes Boston every 4 years. So you kind of, arguably, you could make a case you've diluted that, although there's so many majors in New York for the next 8 years that it doesn't probably matter. You've said basically goodbye to Chicago in this new concept. That's just getting into some, that's just really not making sense. And I just have a hard time visualizing the amount of money they've put into TPC Boston, Jay Monahan's ties there, the success of that event at a place that's not even that well located theoretically, and what that event has done in short time. I just can't believe that that's one that they're going to be able to say goodbye to that easily. And I kind of wonder if some of this stuff going on with the scheduling is also quietly related to that. If a sponsor has stepped up, even if that event went to a non-playoff event, because of course most of us could care less, and maybe finished and was played a week earlier in that stretch between the playoffs and the Open Championship. I don't know. Just seems like that's one that it'll be really odd to say goodbye to. That's a big golf area as well, and a beautiful time of year. And so we'll see. They have a lot of tough questions right now to deal with, and not much time now.
What's the latest with weather in New York this time of year for those PGAs? Not only the Bethpage next year, but how's Rochester looking these days?
Yeah, actually, Rochester had nicer weather last week than Bethpage. I was monitoring several of the sites. I had them on my weather app, and it wasn't very pretty for future PGAs at a few places. But California was super. A little fog, if you don't mind the May gray. But Bethpage was that was going to be a rough one. That was not going to be a pleasant tournament. And as the Preakness showed, the Mid-Atlantic wasn't real hot, and Kiowa had some issues, and on down the list. So I'm really curious to see how this May thing works, and with only two West Coast venues in there. But
I'm wondering what will be worse, St. Louis in August or New York in May?
Well, yeah, it just depends on what you like. But I certainly not looking forward to St. Louis in August. However, I think there's a good chance it'll finish on time. And I'm wondering about the May stops finishing on Sundays, as we just saw this week. So
what are you looking ahead to here? We've got kind of an interesting stretch. We've got Colonial, we've got Memorial, we've got TPC Southwind. I personally, I find the most riveting thing.
I don't know how that fit, but yes, go ahead.
My most riveting thing is Monday qualifying for the sectional qualifying for the U.S. Open in this stretch.
Yeah, if I had to list in the next month what I'm most interested in, it's probably on U.S. Open qualifying. I'd say number two, the NCAA. Golf, both the men and the women. I just, you know, I love match play and I love the dynamics that go on there. Then I'd probably rank the Memorial and then the Colonial. And then I'd probably rank the LA City mid amateur ahead of the TPC Southwind week. That just doesn't excite me much. So, but in terms of, you know, good competition or golf courses, yeah, I think that the, I and speaking of weather, I hope the NCAAs get some good weather. It's kind of a tough time of year there too. And then obviously Shinnecock's just utterly fascinating on every level, setup wise, architecturally. I'm anxious to see how it looks with the. I've only peered through the trees from the National a few years ago during the Walker Cup to see the tree removal. It looks great. Seventh green hasn't changed since 2004, so I'm anxious to see that. So it's going to be great. And then we have right after that we've got the Scottish Open at Gullin and the Open Championship at Carnoustie, so a couple of really fun venues on that front too.
That's one of the things with it. Go back to the schedule that kind of boggles my mind is that, you know, the PGA Tour, obviously they wanted to avoid the NFL season, but
yeah.
You know, like the European Tour kind of owns between the U.S. Open and Open Championship, and I think
right.
they still will. And then you just handed over the prime golf month in the country to
yeah.
them to own. Also, with the September on is going to be, you know, premier event after premier event at a great time of year to play golf.
Yeah, over there and in the U.S. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a head scratcher to me. I think from the schedule changes, I think the European Tour is going to be the biggest winner.
It seems that way. The BMW PGA has just not been great in May, and it'll be phenomenal in September, I think. You know, the question though is they have to deliver eyeballs for a sponsor to be happy, and the fall events just don't get great ratings. The question, I guess, though, that I would pose is, one, the NFL ratings are dropping a little bit, so Sundays are a little more competitive for a variety of reasons. They're still ridiculously good. But the other question that I have is, you know, that time of year is so great. It looks great on TV, but nobody really ever toyed with the idea of a tournament that's played and finishes on a Friday. And I guess, you know, the volunteer wise and all that good stuff, that it's just really hard to
or a Saturday
convince a sponsor to play a tournament Tuesday through Friday to avoid college football and the NFL. But I'm of the belief that September is tough. But by October, before the days get too short, that by then people know what their football team's doing, and they might actually, they've gotten over the euphoria of the first few games, and they might be more into watching playoff golf in October. But obviously that theory was not subscribed to by the PGA Tour. And so, yeah, we're looking at all these compromises, changes, moves designed all around this finish, and you throw in the WGC events, and it's a nightmare. And I, you know, it's a mess, and you just have to wonder if all this is worth making this whole playoff thing work. And obviously it is financially, because the FedEx Cup pays these guys a lot of money, and the tour's job is to give them playing opportunities for money. So
yeah, it just seems like the,
we'll
you know,
see.
With the consolidation, the events that get hurt the most are the non-WGC, non-majors.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if you took away the WGCs tomorrow, suddenly Houston probably gets a sponsor, and you get events that have been weakened get stronger again. I mean, they've really just done – they are number one on my list of the problem. The playoffs, fine, I get it, whatever. If that works, it works, maybe, better format. But the WGCs have just – they're just – I mean, look what the Mexico City one does to the Florida swing and just taking away some players who would play Florida events. It's usually good for the event the week before, or in the vicinity usually, but they're just dreadful. This one, and now they've got to find a spot for the one that's going to be in Memphis. And I don't see how there's just no way it's going to be in the slot between the Open Championship and the first playoff event. No one will play. I don't care how much they tell the guys that it's FedEx. They just won't. They're not going to play Memphis in August. So that one's going to move somewhere to a spot that's better for it. And then it'll hurt some other events. Yeah. So they're just the WGCs, and then they're just generally not guaranteed to be great excitement. There've certainly been good ones, but then the small fields also mean that they're going to be some real duds.
If you were going to redesign, renovate, or restore one tour course, which one would you pick? You could completely blow it up if you really liked the land and build a new course.
So it's an existing venue.
Mm-hmm.
I hate calling Pebble Beach a tour course, but to me, it's the one that most screams out when you look at what it used to be. Needing to be restored, to kind of join the movement of what's gone on at Wingfoot or LA Country Club. I mean, go down the list of the places that have had the really great restorations and where you just say, you know, National Golf Links, and I think now Shinnecock's probably in that category, where you just look at it and you go, well, that's just perfection. That place is as good as it can possibly be. It's like a painting that was dusty, and they've just brought it all back. And Pebble's the one that stands out. I mean, Riviera, they've made a mess of too, obviously, but Pebble's the one where it would just make an incredible statement. And but they have no incentive to do anything. It's just the financial cost of shutting it down for the period of time, and the economic impact on the area would be profound.
It'd be fascinating to see if there was any data with like Pinehurst number 2 undergoing the restoration, and, you know, they shut down obviously, but before and after, and if it made a financial impact, because like I looked at Pinehurst number 2, and that's got to be one of the most important restorations, maybe the most important restoration that golf's had in the last 30 years.
Yeah, I would say the difference there is their play had really started to fall off, because people would go there and say, well, why am I paying $400 to play someplace that looks like, other than the greens, looks like a lot of other courses around? I there's nothing special here. Whereas Pebble's always had, no matter what, even in the years when it wasn't in great shape, it's always had the setting and the history. And so it was able to get by on that, and then the lodge and the area, and the lodge has generally been a great operation. So it's been able to overcome things, whereas I don't think Pinehurst had reached a point where it really couldn't overcome those deficiencies. I can't really think of any other golf course that quite screams out the need for a full rejuvenation like Pebble Beach. Again, I mean, it's great. If you went there tomorrow and played, you'd have a blast. But when you know that what's kind of been lost in some of the holes and some of the nuances and the look, the visual, it could be amazing.
All right, let's get to overrated, underrated here. TrackMan.
Underrated in every regard, I think.
Yeah.
Except by players, good players, they know. But I've had the chat a few times recently with people on the distance topic or on the ball striking topic, and even people who really know the game. I'm not sure they've really delved into what a profound impact it's having on players, and in so many different ways. You know, some guys it makes them practice more. Some it's just a fitting thing. Some it's just a legitimate tool to make little adjustments. That's what's fascinating about it. Is it's impacting players in many different ways. Is that where you had it as an underrated, I presume, by your response?
Yeah, I think it's underrated in this whole distance debate. Is the whole idea of like people figured out how to optimize the launch and everything. And I mean, it's an interesting, you can never take that away. And that makes the ball needing to be rolled back all the more important.
Yep. You're not getting a disagreement from me on that.
All right. Is width overrated or underrated?
It's certainly underrated if the design is one where you can use the width. So it's misunderstood. But I, like I said earlier in the show, the way the guys are able to control the ball with irons now to firm greens, it's becoming very hard to design in a way that makes good use of the width, and also how far they can hit a ball down a hole. You know, they're not hitting, I mean, they're just not hitting long irons. So width is great when you also have a hole where they have a long iron, and the smart guy or Webb Simpson can hit their little cut hybrid from the left side because they wisely hit a nice little draw down the left to give themselves the best angle to that far right pin and be able to play with Dustin Johnson, who hit it down the right side, but has an 8-iron, but a crappy angle. But now if Dustin Johnson can hold that green, even when it's a little firm with the 8-iron, the width becomes kind of, overrated, but it's just muted. It just becomes nullified.
I think the thing people focus on is like how wide it is, but like I think what you hit on is for the variety of players, width is so important because that width allows shorter guys a chance. And if it's narrow with thick rough, like, you know, everybody's going to miss fairways, you know? And width allows a shorter hitter who's a little bit more tactical and accurate to really play a different style of golf and use their strength versus when it's long and narrow, they just have no chance.
No, especially when you read the comments of guys like, I mean, Finau, and there was a Wall Street Journal piece last week where he just, you know, bomb and gouge is back. It's just there is, unless the rough is lost ball rough, it's just stupid for him to ever think about playing back when he can advance the ball and have a sand wedge versus a 6-iron. Just doesn't make sense.
And that's
not a good place to be for competitive golf.
So, last one, a good caddy.
Oh, definitely underrated. You know, I mean, whether it's a recreational round where they just a good one just knows how to knows when to speak and when not to, and then obviously on the tour, just watching, you know, last week how important the caddy was, because of course nobody apparently can play 18 holes anymore in practice for whatever reason. So the caddies were just so heavily relied on last week, and you know, I don't know what Aaron Wise's caddy did for him. It may not have mattered the way he hit the ball, but there were certainly other guys who, I guarantee you, if you went back and talked to them about the effort their caddy made to scope out the course on Monday and or even the year before, it would be really interesting to hear where they can kind of now look back and go, well, he saved me a couple shots because he just said, do not go at that pin kind of thing. So, I would love, you know, but that's going deep into areas that, and now, of course, if you want to ask those questions of players and caddies, it's, top secret information that I mean, I try to follow up. Were you there when Billy Hurley was in talking about course stats?
No.
Not Billy Hurley. What am I talking? Jeez.
Horschel?
Billy Horschel was in. And he started talking about his analysis. And, you know, he's turned that over to his caddy and his stat person. And I tried to ask a follow-up saying, so, and not, I just thought it was fascinating. But, of course, his, you know, he thinks I'm out to get him and all that. I don't know why. But he let it out there that he kind of touched around it, but they basically would look at the golf course after 36 holes and adjust their game plan based on some of the shot link data. And I think that's just, I just think that's fascinating. I mean, you imagine players of the past would love to be able to do that. And he was like, I don't want to give anyone any secrets. Yeah. I don't want your secrets. I just want to confirm. So you're going to, you know, there's a good chance you'll take that data. You guys will say, well, everybody driving the fifth green is averaging 3.9, whereas the guys laying up are averaging 3.5. So why aren't we just laying up? That kind of thing that's cool. I think that's fascinating. But most of the players don't ever want to talk about that. I tried to do a story on that, and they just, that's sort of between me and my stat guy. Like it's a doctor, patient privilege situation. Like guys, you please calm down now. These are not important matters. It's okay to, there are people who would find this interesting. It's you're not going to give away the secret sauce.
I think you're missing the most valuable caddy of the weekend, guy that beats up your competitor.
Well, okay, yeah. Now that's another dynamic that you know, a good caddy does. He waits in the parking lot and sucker punches somebody. Maybe after a couple of drinks, maybe not. I don't know. Allegedly, this is all alleged, of course. But,
for those not picking up, this is the odd story of the Florida Mid-Am this week. So hopefully more details surface
down there in Florida. Yeah.
It's, as you put it, you know, the Stream Song Caddyshack must be interesting.
Wow. Place. Yeah, they're both employed there, and I think thankfully the Caddyshack's a little quieter in the summertime, so maybe they're not there. Maybe they moved on to cooler climates. But yeah, I having worked in a Caddyshack a little bit in my youth, I can imagine that dynamic is awkward.
Yeah, it's the good news is if you're playing at Stream Song, they've got you, the player, in their best interest. Your
yeah,
friends, your
yeah. I don't
friends
know if you
want
to sucker
worry.
Punch a resort guest. I don't know if that's going to work for you. Allegedly. Yeah. So there were signs on the inside of his mouth of bleeding.
Yeah, concussion-like symptoms. Trying.
I had
to
read the story twice, though. It's very confusing. It kind of needs. I mean, it's not that Ryan Lavner did a great job writing it. There's just you got to know the names, and it's a little tricky to follow. But it certainly is taking things to a different level.
Yeah, we got to go to our friend of the pod, Kyle, and sometimes co-host Kyle Nathan. He's gonna give us the dirt.
Okay.
He was on the ground.
Okay.
So, hey Jeff, thanks for coming on. Thanks for the time. Always enjoy the banter. And for listeners, you can find Jeff at his website, jeffshackelford.com. Writing also on Golf Week and on Morning Drive. You got anything exciting coming up?
Well, yeah, I'm doing a couple things for Golf Week for our U.S. Open preview, kind of recapping the 2004 debacle. And we are working on a feature for the coverage during the U.S. Open on that course setup thing and kind of the things that have come out of it that allow the USGA to basically not repeat what happened in that setup. So it was a zany event, you know, I going back and reading all that. So I think it's going to be interesting to kind of rehash that. And, you know, what makes it interesting, Andy, is that the last US Open at Shinnecock 2004 followed Olympia Fields, where there was a sense the year before the course was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And the players kind of had their way with it. And here we are again, deja vu all over again. There was that sense at Erin Hills, players had their way with it. And we tightened some fairways at Shinnecock, apparently. And now we're even maybe nudging a few of them out from a couple of reports I got. But the same dynamic exists that occurred last time. The difference is, you know, the USGA has better stem meter readings, better weather forecasting, true firm to measure firmness, and then, of course, moisture readings to track all that. So they have no excuse, theoretically, but if you've ever seen the seventh green at Shinnecock Hills, I don't know what green speed that green works at. So it's got to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's
because we don't have to play it. We don't have to set it up.
Yeah, it's very true.
We just watch.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about being a viewer. And I forgot Shack House, you know, so
yes, Shack House. We got a couple of interesting guests possibly coming up. So all U.S. Open preview related. So I'm excited about that, too.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, cool. Thanks for coming on again, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, enjoyed the chatting today and last week, and don't worry, it'll be firmer and faster next year.
All right, hopefully.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.